On November the 1st, 1755, there was a terrible earthquake in Lisbon, Portugal. The temblor itself lasted, they say, about 10 minutes, destroyed much of the city. But then, as would be the case about 150 years later in San Francisco, there were terrible fires that broke out after the earthquake. They killed many more people. Many of the survivors went to the seashore to get away from the fires, and then a tsunami arrived and killed many who were on the shore. Now, this terrible event sent shockwaves across Europe, and I mean that now metaphorically. It sent shockwaves through the intelligentsia of Europe, because though people in the 18th century, maybe in their ancient history books, had read about Pompeii or, you know, ancient disasters, no one had experienced or heard about a disaster on this scale. How to reconcile it with belief in a personal providential God? This began to preoccupy a lot of the religious and intellectual leaders of Europe. Many of the major players at the time, think of Kant and Rousseau, Voltaire, all weighed in on this dilemma of the Lisbon earthquake. The basic conclusion was it was irreconcilable with belief in a personal providential God. It just didn't seem possible that such a God would permit such a terrible disaster. People say, well, maybe, you know, an abstract God, the God of deism, a distant cosmic force, but not the personal God of the Bible. It just doesn't make sense. Well, I thought of the Lisbon earthquake the minute I heard about this recent disaster in Japan, because it was an eerily similar scenario, with the earthquake itself, followed by massive destruction, followed by the tsunami, and followed by the inevitable questions about God and such a disaster. You know, there are two very easy options when it comes to this question, and you see them up and down the ages. The one is to say, well, clearly it's divine retribution. Clearly this is God expressing his anger about something. So we saw, for example, in the wake of the Japan earthquake, there was actually a governor, a local governor in Japan, who spoke out and said, this is divine retribution. Later he apologized for that, but that was his first reaction. In our country, Glenn Beck said something similar, evidently, that this was a sign of God's retribution. In other disasters, people like Pat Robertson have chimed in, you know, in a similar way. What's the problem with that? Well, the problem with that is the Bible itself gives the lie to it. Look in the book of Job. So Job is this sort of archetype of the suffering human being that's undergone the worst sort of trials in every way. His friends, in quotes, come along, and they endeavor to explain his suffering precisely using this kind of logic. Clearly, Job, you've done something, because God would only attack you this way if you had done something. And Job consistently and rightly says no. And then the book of Job gives a much more nuanced answer to the problem. It refuses this kind of easy option of simply saying, oh yes, I know, it must have been God seeking retribution. Now, I say there are two easy answers. That's one. The other one is the answer of the agnostics and atheists that would simply say, well, it proves obviously there's no God, or most likely there's no God. How could God ever be reconciled with such disaster? I think the truth of it lies beyond those easy options. And our great tradition articulates it rather remarkably well. Here's the first observation to make. God can never be construed as the cause of evil. Now, two reasons for that. One is because God is love. That's all God is, straight through. He's love. Therefore, God cannot will something wicked. You can't say God is directly willing something evil. The second reason is that God is described as being itself. Therefore, God cannot ground or cause the non-being which is evil. Evil, in the strict metaphysical sense, doesn't exist. It's a privation of the good, we say. It's a lack of being that ought to be there. Think of a cavity in a tooth. You know, it's a lack of some integrity that ought to be there. So God, as being itself, can't be the causal ground of evil. That's why we shouldn't talk about God causing or willing directly evil or suffering. So what do we say? We say that God permits certain evils in his creation to bring about a greater good. Now again, it's a category that makes sense. I mean, we see that happening in our own lives. Sometimes certain evils have happened, but out of them come a greater good that would never have happened without the evil. We know about that. And let me give you a framework maybe for thinking about some of these really disastrous evils. Hitler, Stalin. You say, well, how could God have possibly permitted what they did? Well, God wants the great good of free will. He desires us to be his friends and not just his puppets. And therefore, he wants free will. Well, see, to want free will is at the same time to allow for the abuse of free will. You can't have free will without allowing for the abuse of free will. So you might say God allows people like Hitler and Stalin and all sorts of other wicked people so as to bring about the greater good or to permit the greater good of free will itself. Now follow that line analogously. John Polkinghorne, I've mentioned before, is an Anglican priest and also a particle physicist. So he's a very high-level scientist and a priest. He's written very provocatively on religion science issues. He says analogous to this free will explanation is what he calls a free process explanation. What do I mean? I mean that God wants his creation. He wants nature to have its own integrity. God lets it be and lets it unfold according to its own rhythms. So, this tsunami was caused by an earthquake. An earthquake caused by the shifting of tectonic plates. Those plates are ingredient in the very structure of the earth. The earth is the way it is because of its relation to the sun and the solar system, etc., etc. That it's the result, if you want, of natural processes that God has allowed to unfold according to their own rhythms. So God allows the world to have its own rhythms and processes, even when these result in things that are, from our perspective, both good and bad. I'll give you an example that I'm taking from Polkinghorne. The very dynamic, namely a random genetic mutation, that gives rise to evolution also gives rise to cancer. And so it's a natural process that has both good and bad consequences. Okay, let me put a kind of final broad perspective on this. We say God allows evil to bring about a greater good. There's a famous story in the Chinese tradition that speaks of a farmer. And the farmer has a horse that has run away. His friends come and they commiserate with him on the loss of his horse. He says, "We'll see." A week later, that horse returns with three other horses that he's brought back to the farm. His friends come and they say, "How wonderful, what good luck, these new horses have come." He says, "We'll see." His son gets on one of the new horses and rides around and falls off and breaks his leg. The friends come back and they say, "How terrible, what terrible luck you've had." He says, "We'll see." A week later, the officials from the government come to draft the son into the army. They discover he has a broken leg, they won't draft him. The friends come back and say, "Well, congratulations, what good luck." He says, "We'll see." And the story goes on in that vein, making a simple but I think very penetrating point that it's next to impossible for us ever to read the full consequences of an act or an event. What appears to us to be simply good or simply evil, given the way things unfold, is never all that clear. So, people of faith look at the world. Now, people of faith, I mean people that believe in God and believe in a life that stretches, yes, even beyond this one. We look at the goods and evils of this world and we say, well, what does it all mean? We'll see. We'll see what the effects of even this terrible event in Japan are. And we'll see in light of God's ultimate providence of the universe.